always nice to see the extended family. So I'm sure many of you can relate. This week was a rough week. And on Tuesday especially, I had a series of bad events. I had stuff happen that I didn't know could happen. I had a flat tire when I first went to pull out of the garage in the morning Tuesday. And if you remember, it was a really rainy day. So everything's got kind of a backdrop of rain and dark and gloom. Had a flat tire, put some air into it, drove it down to Costco and said, hey, fix this tire. They normally can do that. They said, sure, we'll get to it in an hour. 2 hours later, I'm sitting there. Yeah, we're just about to pull it into the bay. I'm like, okay, thanks. They pull it into the bay. They go, we got bad news. Your tire's fine. And I go, no, it's flat. Oh, no, your tire's fine. Your wheel is broken. You've got a break in the wheel that came from running over too many potholes. And I go, well, we can imagine that happens. So I spent the rest of the week trying to get my wheel fixed. I thought you just had flat tires, but it gets more complicated. Anyway, I was in a really bad mood on Tuesday. I don't know, Chris can probably attest to it. It happens every now and then with me. The kids can certainly attest to it, and I'm sure you've been there. I was angry, I was sullen, I didn't want to talk to anybody. And so my solution is I typically just back off, I say, stay away, live your lives. I'll be fine as soon as I can get my head around this. But I got to thinking about it, and I was really bothered by the fact that I was getting angry over stupid stuff. So I had a flat tire. So it was raining. So they lied to me. There was some other stuff. Oh yeah, my glasses broke. While I'm in the middle of all this stuff, my reading glasses, which I don't need, but it's much better if I have my reading glasses, broke. Thankfully, I was at Costco, so I picked up 3 more and it worked out. But I was reminded, and I'm sure this was from God, I was reminded of Romans 8:28. For those that don't know it as a memory verse, we joked about that this week, it says, and we know that all things work together for good for those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. So if I would summarize it in non-biblical terms, everything works out the way it's supposed to because God is steering the events in our lives, right? We know that this is for the best even if we don't like it. So I was struggling with the spiritual knowledge that things were going exactly as they should in my life for me to grow as a Christian and draw closer to God. But I wasn't taking it that way. I was very angry about it. And I was also very bothered by Psalms 119 verse 165, which is another memory verse. Great peace have they who love your law, and nothing will make them stumble. Here I was stumbling over a flat tire, some rain, broken glasses, right? And I asked myself while I was fuming and sequestering myself, what was going on? If I knew that things were working the way they were supposed to be, if I knew that if I loved God's law, which I did, I wouldn't be stumbling, what was the problem that I was having? So that's what I spent the last hours of that day looking at. And I realized, and again, this is very human and easy to relate to, I was angry because even though the day was going exactly as it should, it wasn't going the way I wanted it to go. It wasn't going according to my plans. I had my plans about how I was going to go to work and I was going to do this thing. I forgot to mention work. I had this stupid problem where we were off by $700,000 that wasn't adding up, and that wasn't fun, and my boss wasn't happy about that, and all those sorts of things. But the day was not going the way Kirk Talbot had decided it should go. And I realized, if you think about it, that's exactly what James said leads to war. So if you turn over to James 4, verse 1, you'll read a wonderfully pivotal, I won't say a memory verse, but you'll read a wonderfully pivotal series of verses about something that happens a lot in this world. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have. I desired to have a different day than what was going on, but I didn't get it, so I was angry. You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and you cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask, and you ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. When we get our, I'll say, expectations aligned one way, and we want what we want, and we want it to be a certain way, is when God says everything starts going wrong. And if you keep persisting in that, it leads to wars and murder and death and sin. So I want to talk today about wrong expectations or false expectations or however you want to set it, misleading expectations, where we want one thing that is absolutely not in line with truth, it's not in line with God's way, but we want it nonetheless. And where the disappointment comes from when our expectations get out of way with reality. I told you that my solution was to pull away, kind of back off, just say, please don't talk to me, which is confusing because I'm normally a very social person and most people go, hey, what's wrong with you? And I go, that's the last thing I want to do right now is talk to you about what's wrong with me. I just need some space, right? I go to bed, I sleep, I wake up in the morning, and I typically feel better. Christina will test every now and then it takes 2 days, but most days it's over in one night, which is, I'm thankful for that. That's a blessing. The next day, though, I have to admit, didn't go better. In fact, it went worse. But my attitude had changed because now my expectations were really, really, really low. I had a broken wheel, not a broken tire, and I had to figure out how to fix a broken wheel, right? I had this $700,000 I knew I'd been yelled at because of this thing that happened. And as it turned out, we had a much worse crisis at work the next day. We had there's a mobile app at our company that alerts people when something's happened with a train route or a bus route. It's how we communicate that there's been a service disruption. Very, very critical. That app failed at 6 o'clock Wednesday evening. Didn't work anymore. MARTA lost all ability to communicate to the world that things were happening. At 7 o'clock, roughly, someone decided to throw themselves in front of one of our trains. At 8 o'clock, we had a soccer match letting out with 40,000 people that all wanted to ride the train home. You can imagine the chaos that ensued over the next few hours. Actually, it took us 2 or 3 days. We just mopped up kind of the mess this weekend, technically speaking. Arguably, that's a lot worse than my flat tire. But I was able to handle the situation emotionally much better because my expectations had been reset to zero. And that's what I want to talk about today. Not how to reset our expectations, but more importantly, what causes our expectations to drift? Because we start off at the end of a Sabbath or at the end of a fast. When we're aligned with God, we're full of humility, right? Our expectations are hopefully much better set about what our life should look like, what our experience with God's going to be like, all the challenges we're going to have in life. But our expectations drift over time. And what had happened was on Tuesday, my expectations had drifted to the point, as you can imagine, I expected to get into my car, it would start, and the tires would do their job. I expected to get in my car, and my reading glasses would work. I expected to go to work and not be yelled at for some mistake that someone else had made. Right? On the surface, those aren't unreasonable expectations. But at that day, those were unreasonable expectations. I was wrong. That's not how reality was going to play out. My wife shared with me, and I think it was maybe on Tuesday, maybe it was Wednesday, day before, a quote from C.S. Lewis that is fantastic and points us right back to Psalm 119:165. Life with God is not immunity from difficulties, but peace in difficulties. We all know that. God doesn't promise us an easy life. But if we stay close to Him and we stay aligned with Him, He promises us a peace that passes all understanding. And I'm sure most of you have experienced that. Times that are horrifically bad. And God gives you that sense of peace that you couldn't describe to anyone else and most people wouldn't understand. But being in a close relationship with God, you feel it. That was the sort of peace I had on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Again, not because the world around me was calm and peaceful, but because my expectations had been reset. So, I want to cut to the heart of the matter. I'll talk about the elephant in the room. The antidote to all of our expectations drifting are humility, right? And I'm not going to end it with just that, but I would be remiss if I didn't point out, when our expectations start to drift, what's really happening is we're saying, hey, I'm pretty important. I think the universe should go this way, whatever it is. If we are humble, we view ourselves in relationship with God properly, and we view ourselves in relationship to each other properly, and no matter what happens, we accept it because we're humble, That's one of the fruits of humility, is acceptance and peace with what happens around you. So, Philippians 2, if you'll turn there. Christ gives us, and this really is the antidote to all of our expectational drift. But I'm not going to spend too much time on it. I just want to make sure we highlight it. I want to talk the rest of the message about why do our expectations drift so that we can be watchful of them. But if you'll turn to Philippians 2, verse 3 through 8. Again, nothing you haven't heard before. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves. Not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interest of the others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant. Being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on the cross. So Christ set the example for us, and he tells us if we esteem everyone else around us as more important, we will inherently be in a state of humility, which resets our expectations back to nobody owes me anything. Life doesn't owe me anything. So anything that happens is something that I will deal with. I can tell you this, after 24 years of marriage, Chris and I figured out one of those little secret rules of thumb. Almost every conflict we have ever gotten into is when she emotionally needed something and therefore expected something, and I emotionally needed something else and expected something else at the same time. When she emotionally needs something and expects it, and I don't have any needs, sure, honey, here it is, no problem. When I need attention or I need something, and she has no emotional needs, she's able to give it to me. But when we're both expecting from the relationship at the same time, and we're not available to give to our mate, that's when the fights happen. Well, if you would just give me this thing, then I could take care of that thing, right? And what we realized is, and I'm not saying we do it perfectly, but at least we see the pattern. When we get in that state, one of us has to back down, put aside our expectations, our needs for the moment, take care of the other, and then the whole relationship can restore, right? Again, it's about expectations. When we go into it both expecting to get, that's when we have a conflict. So, what are the reasons why our expectations drift? They get out of alignment with God's will, with God's vision for what's coming. The first and obvious, and those academics among us would probably say this is the only answer, so I'll start here, is pride. Our pride tells us that we deserve whatever, right? Look no further than Satan for an example of that. We'll turn there in a second. But first, I want to remind us of where we live. This is probably one of the biggest challenges we will have as Americans. Those listening from other countries, you have one advantage. You don't have quite as much materialism, and you don't have quite as much marketing telling you that you are the center of the universe. You deserve a new car every year. You deserve the nicest house possible. You deserve every fine thing in existence in this world. And you know what? I say in here pride, but I wrote it down as pride plus time. When you're bombarded constantly with how important you are, how much you deserve, you start to believe it. And Madison Avenue knows that. So we as Americans are bombarded with it. It's an extra challenge that we have. But look at Isaiah 14. And turn to Isaiah 14 and we'll see the example of Satan. Because he's the author and he's the originator of all pride issues, right? He was the first one that had this. Isaiah 14, verse 13 through 14. Isaiah 14, verse 13. Here we go. You said in your heart, I will ascend to the heavens. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the mountain of the assembly, on the utmost heights of Mount Zaphon. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Why did Satan do that? Or why did Lucifer do that? Because he was proud. He thought he deserved it. He thought in his splendor and his marvel, He deserved equality with God, if not superiority to him, right? We know that. Even in his first attack on humanity, when he went after Adam and Eve, he used pride. You'll be like God if you eat this fruit. He was pushing pride on us, right? Pride gets in there and it tells us, you deserve that thing. It would be foolish of you not to expect that thing. You are so important. And that little voice goes into all of our heads. We all know it. And that is the root, at the end of the day, why most of our expectations drift over time. It's not because we're doing Bible study. It's not because we don't understand God's will for us. It's because we listen to that extra voice outside of our head that tells us we deserve more. We deserve a carefree life. That's pride. So what is, well, I'll give you another example, which is a little bit more human and I thought was interesting. Yeah, because it's in the same chapter. Turn to Esther 5. Hopefully everyone remembers the story of Esther. For those that are a little rusty, the fundamental story was Esther, through a series of events, became queen to King Xerxes. And her uncle Mordecai had foiled a plot that was an assassination attempt on King Xerxes. But there was a man by the name of Haman who really hated the Jews for some reason. And he had a situation where Mordecai, who was Jewish, didn't show him the respect that he thought he deserved. Again, if Haman had been working from a position of humility, wouldn't have been a problem. His expectations would have been appropriate. It was fine. But Haman had issues there. So in Esther chapter 5, verse 9, we see the situation where Mordecai has just offended Haman, right? And so Haman went out that day, verses 9 through 14 of Esther. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, how dare he not respect me? Doesn't he know how important I am? I'm offended. Great peace have they who love my law. Nothing shall offend them. So here you see pride flaring up in Haman. He was filled with rage against Mordecai. What happened to me when my tire went flat? I was angry. I was indignant that the universe could treat me this way, right? It's all about me. How dare the universe not respect who I am? Haman got angry. I got angry. That's one of the telltale signs that your expectations are drifting way out of alignment. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. That verse cracks me up. Makes it sound like he's a better guy than I thought he was going to be. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them, again, boasted, about his vast wealth. Hey, did everybody in the audience know how rich I am? I want to put that out there, right? That's a normal conversational topic. His many sons and all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she's invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this, everything that I've accumulated, all my amazingness, does not give me satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. How ridiculous is that statement? You're blessed above all people in the kingdom, and the only thing that offends you is this guy, this insignificant guy sitting at a gate. You can hear the pride dripping from him. His wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, have a pole set up, reaching to a height of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. There's the kind of wife you want to have, really encouraging you to make wise decisions. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. So here you see a more human example, quite extreme actually, of pride. Just amazing pride. Now, what is the antidote when we are faced with pride creeping into our life, maladjusting our expectations? Well, turn back to Esther 4, so one chapter back. The best human example that I can see, I mean, Christ was perfect and he gives us examples throughout. But look at Esther 4, verse 16. This was the situation where Haman was going to have the Jews killed, right? He was going to have the Jews killed, Mordecai as well. And the conversation where Mordecai says to his niece, Esther, You've been made queen quite possibly for this situation so that you can help protect the Jews. Look at her response, though, when she understands what she needs to do and move forward. She says to Mordecai, her uncle, go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, so she's going to God. Remember what the process of fasting does. It humbles us before God, right? It resets us, all of our expectations, so that they're aligned with God, because we remember we are insignificant. Nothing we do matters. It's about our relationship with God. I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And the law at the time was if she went to the king and he didn't say, come on in, because she wasn't invited, she'd be put to death. So she was sacrificing her life as far as she knew. She didn't know what the outcome would be. And if I perish, I perish. Imagine that from a standpoint of humility, right? I'm effectively sacrificing my life in the hopes that this will play out well. It does, but she could not have known that at that point in time. But the reason I mentioned it was twofold. One, there was a great show of humility on her part to reset and counter any kind of pride that she might have. And two, her expectations were properly aligned. She knew what reality was. I have a very high chance of walking into that room and being executed. No matter what happens from that point forward, she's already expected the worst. Anything beyond that, not being killed, that's a great day for her, right? Her expectations, well, you could see Haman's expectations were stratospheric in terms of what he expected everyone to do for him. Her expectations were zero. I probably won't make this out of this alive. That's the level, that is the power of humility, how it resets our expectations back to reality. Now, there are three other things that drift our expectations apart from pride. And I couldn't speak on all the ways that pride gets into us, but you're familiar with those. The first I want to mention in the time that remains is blessings. Blessings plus time. And again, those that are academic could probably argue that each of the three things I'm going to say, what they really do is they fuel our pride, which is true. But if I just left this at pride, you would be out looking for situations where pride creeps into your life. And the reality is, for anybody that's lived more than a few years, understands pride creeps into your life in every direction simultaneously. It's like, which direction does darkness come from when I turn out the lights? Everywhere. So when you're looking for pride from the west, it's going to come after you from the east or the north or the south. So that's why I want to talk about these three other examples that we see in the Bible of expectations drifting and what caused them. So the first one is blessings plus time. Turn over to Deuteronomy 8, and we'll see a warning from God. Here he's talking to Israel about, I'm going to take you into the promised land, and I'm going to bless you as I promised I would. And there's two possible outcomes to this. You will either remember me as your maker, and you will have a proper relationship with me, and things will work out well. But if you don't, watch what happens. Deuteronomy 8, verse 11. Be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God, failing to observe his commands, his laws, and his decrees that I am giving you this day. Spoiler, this is what happened to Israel. God knew it was coming, but he told them. Verse 12, otherwise, when you eat and are satisfied, when you build fine houses and settle down, and when your herds and your flocks grow large and your silver and gold increase and all you have is multiplied. Sound familiar? The blessings are heaped upon you in ways that others can't even comprehend. Then your heart will become proud. See, there it is. Blessings lead to pride. And you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. And if you skip down to verse 17, here are the words that you will utter when you've become so blessed that your expectations are out of line. You may say to yourself, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me. You'll forget where the blessings came from. You will believe that you somehow did it all. And that leads to a pride and an expectation that says, I deserve a raise. I deserve a mansion. I deserve every conceivable blessing in my life. I'll be honest, one of the biggest triggers for me, better knock on wood, given our luck around here, air conditioning. I have had air conditioning my whole life growing up in Texas. So when I walk into a room that doesn't have air conditioning, I become indignant. I'm like, how could the creators of this building have hated me so much, right? That's my problem. That's my blessing pride. But there are billions of people on this planet that have never experienced air conditioning in their life, right? And here I take it as a birthright because I've enjoyed the blessing my whole life. And it's funny, but I sweat easily, so, you know, it's all interconnected. My point is, we in America have an especially difficult time with this, not because we're bad people or because we're any more materialistic than anyone else, but we're swimming in so many blessings, we don't even realize our expectations of continued blessing. And spoiler alerts, as empires diminish, the blessings evaporate too, right? So it's a warning to us that as the blessings in our life evaporate, or times become harder, will we adjust our expectations properly? Or will we curse the universe for failing to give us what we were entitled to? We as Christians know what we're supposed to do, but that doesn't make it easy, right? Now, what is the antidote to blessings plus time? Thankfulness. Turn back to Deuteronomy 8:18. If you didn't, actually, we're still there. Never mind, no need to turn, forgive me. My notes make it too easy. He tells us what to do in this situation to avoid the blessing trap. But remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth. And in Ephesians 5, verses 20 to 21, he says, always giving thanks to God the Father for everything in the name of your Lord Jesus Christ. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Again, he's combined there the humility with the constant thankfulness. When we spend our time constantly thanking God for the blessings we have, we realize they're blessings. We realize we're not entitled to them. We realize they may not be there tomorrow. And it resets our expectations back to what's realistic, what is appropriate, right? The second one, and this one may not be as obvious, but if you unpack this story, it's effectively the story of this prophet. The second piece is our desires plus time. And this is a little bit different than blessings. And yes, it is a subset of pride, but it's what we want. Turn over to Jonah 4. Hopefully everybody here knows the story of Jonah. Jonah, God tells Jonah, hey, I need you to go tell Nineveh, stop being bad. Jonah, convinced that that's a bad idea, again, his expectations are wrong, thinks he can outrun God, gets thrown into, well, long story short, gets thrown into a big fish, redirected back to where he's supposed to be, gets spit out, goes and talks to Nineveh. Nineveh repents. And in chapter 4, turn to Jonah chapter 4, verses 1 through, I won't read through the whole section, but basically chapter 4 is Jonah telling God, I told you so. See, you didn't listen to me. Why? And listen to how he starts out in verse 1. But to Jonah, this seemed very wrong, and he became angry. This is because Nineveh repented, the very thing God wanted to have happen. Romans 8:28. All things work together. God used Jonah despite himself. Nineveh got better. Jonah's like, I told you, this is just wrong. And I'm sure God's going, what in the world are you talking about? We just succeeded, right? But he's smarter than that. But to Jonah, this seemed very wrong, and he became angry. Why was he angry? Because things didn't go the way he wanted. He told God this wouldn't work. He prayed to the Lord, isn't this what I said, Lord? Can you hear the dripping expectations of, I was right? And the audacity to say this to God. When I was still at home, that is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. See, I tried to prevent this, God, but you wouldn't let me. I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, I wasn't this bad, but look at how Jonah responds. Verse 3. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it's better for me to die than to live. I wasn't like, God, kill me now. I got a flat tire. I can't handle this. This isn't right. We're off by $700,000, and on top of that, my reading glasses are broken. Just kill me now. I say that, and the rest of chapter 4 is him pouting about why this is wrong, and he was right. His beliefs, what he wanted, his desire, was his expectation. Now, what's interesting, the antidote to this is obedience, right? It's what I had to apply when my wheel broke and everything else. I didn't have a choice. I had to go along with the wheel, and I had to accept that this was the path I was on. Turn back to Jonah 2, and I'll give you the anecdote from the same man that was guilty of the fault, the poor expectations. Here we are in chapter 2, and we see this is after Jonah had tried to flee to Tarshish to prevent God from forgiving Nineveh. And he got swallowed by the whale. And he had that, what do they call it, a come to Jesus moment, where he said, this isn't right. This isn't what I want. This isn't working out. So he prayed. So chapter 2 is his prayer to God. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. He said, in my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From deep in the realm of the dead, I called for help, and you listened to my cry. You hurried me into the depths, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled about me. All your waves and breakers swept over me, and I said, I have been banished from your sight, yet I will look again toward your holy temple. He's humbling himself. He's accepting his fate. He's aligning to obey God, and it's resetting his attitude. Now, this should show us a few things. One, how we deal with drifting from our own desires. It's resetting back to the obedience of God. But it should also comfort us that this man, who had reset his expectations while in the belly of the well, drifted again just a few days later after he saw Nineveh forgiven by God, right? So this isn't a one-time fix. We fix our expectations and they're all better. This is a forever battle that we're constantly looking to fight. And one day you can be winning it, the next day you can be losing it. But thankfully, in my case, I was losing on Tuesday. On Wednesday, I reset, and despite a lot of really bad stuff, it worked out better. Everything worked out better because my attitude and expectations are better. There's one last one that I will get very briefly, and I won't go through all the scriptures. And this is a nefarious one, because our expectations will drift because of our friends, those people that we surround ourselves with. And in the interest of time, I won't go through all of them, but we'll talk about the example of Job. Job started off, and I quote, have you considered my servant Job in Job 1:8? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. God said those words about Job. And at the beginning of his trial, his wife said, curse God and die. And Job's expectations were very appropriate. He said, you're talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Job's expectations were right. God can deliver good things in our life, and God can deliver the bad things in our life. But what you see over the next 30-ish chapters, 35 chapters, is a series of friends that are constantly judging him, and it wears him down. It's not that their judgment led him to be prideful. It was that his rejection of their, I don't even know what you call it, faux friendship in that moment, drained him to the point that he started focusing on himself, and he started seeing his plight as so bad that God had made a mistake, right? He didn't go into it with a righteous attitude. That's not what God says. The situation with his friends wore him down to the point where he became prideful, and we know how it ends. God finally responds back to him and says, whoa, who are you to be telling me this, right? His expectations in verse 2 of, if I'm to die, I'm to die. That's God's will, I accept that, had drifted to the point, if God would just show himself, I could have a fair conversation with him. That was the actions of his friends and the grief that he was going through, right? So here we see external factors that can cause our expectations to drift, not in the way we expect, but in very dark places. So what's the antidote to that? The antidote to that, I propose, is that we always seek God's will, right? It's effectively embedded in Romans 8:28. When I knew that I was having the day I was supposed to be having, even though I didn't like the day I was having, I went back and said, okay, God, show me what you would have me do. Show me where I'm supposed to go. Show me what steps I'm supposed to take because my expectations are wrong and I'm not getting it. Look at how Christ responded, and I want you to think about this. Christ is a human. Turn to Matthew 26, verses 38 through 39. This is a situation where Christ, after the Passover supper, he's gone up on the hill, he's praying for the last time before he's about to be betrayed. Matthew 26, then he said to them, and he's talking to his disciples that are there, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and he prayed. And you know this prayer because we go over it every year at Passover. "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me," right? That's the human side that says, is there any way other than me being crucified horribly and painfully to atone for all of humanity's sins? But the appropriate God's will seeker in him said, "Yet not as I will, but as you will." When he did that, he was resetting his expectations back to, I know what I'd like. I'd like for there to be an alternative method, but it doesn't matter. What matters is your will. I want your will, and I'm aligning my expectation that whatever you send down the pipe at me, that is what I want. That is what I will follow. When we reset our expectations back to God's will, when we seek his will, again, it resets us. We go, not my will, your will. And then we can deal with whatever comes at us. And back to what C.S. Lewis said, it's not that it will be easier, but God will give us the peace because we are aligned with him. And we know that we accept what comes next. We won't be fighting it because it won't be counter to our expectations. Why do I talk about this? I talk about this because, you know, our country is going in a weird direction. And it's going in multiple directions simultaneously. It's not any one thing. It's a whole bunch of things. And our expectations, the momentum of our expectations are, we've been blessed as a nation. We have had so many good things. We expect the air conditioning work, the high-speed internet, the Wi-Fi, the everything, right? And as the country gets crazier, the things that we always took for granted won't be possible. And that's just a reality. None of us can change that. The only thing we can do, as I told someone this week, is choose our attitude, how we respond to that. If we expect things to go well for us, we're going to have a bad non-Christian response, which is what I did on Tuesday. If we expect things to be poor, that we are not entitled to anything, that we are going to have a rough life, that it's going to be challenging in the things that we took for granted, maybe it's employment, maybe it's the ability to meet peacefully on the Sabbath, those are no longer guaranteed. Then we will have a humble attitude, we will be able to seek God's will, and we'll be able to navigate through that situation much better. But if we're not on guard, if we're not watching out for our expectational drift, we will trip up and we will stumble over the little things that aren't necessary, but are definitely coming at us. So I wanted to share that part of my life because it can slip by so easily. We can feel so entitled so quickly, but it's such a spiritual danger for all of us. And hopefully everyone can be on watch as things progress the way that they progress.